More than 10,000 either detained or missing, kidnapped, abducted, some taken from hospital beds. It is Assad type, Mubarak type.
Yeah.
We've seen this before.
Sheikh Hasina is trying to solidify and preserve her power.
But this is bad, Jalal.
Really?
This is really bad, brother. What Hasina does, she plays on the emotions of the people. You basically have made the students a target.
I mean, how many people came out?
At least 100,000, if not more. The quota system is one way in which you maintain and preserve the regime. The conversation in Bangladesh is not about the rising cost of living. It's the cost of surviving. It is in India's favor to keep Bangladesh as a vassal state.
Bangladesh is in crisis. A 15-year rule by one woman and one party, the Awami League, has turned into something resembling a dictatorship. With jobs given to cronies and police intimidation, the grip of the country's elites and their desire to hold on to power and privilege intensifies daily. This is not typical of the Muslim world, but a friend of mine in the student movement in Bangladesh told me that what he was witnessing was an Assad-style repression over the last week. The crisis began when students nationwide protested against the imposition of quotas for civil service jobs, some of the most stable around. An economic downturn meant that the already surplus demand would make it nearly impossible to land employment in a country with high youth unemployment. This has spiraled into something bigger, and the country's security services have responded with lethal force. Now, to help us understand the situation in Bangladesh, I would like to welcome to the show journalist and commentator Dili Hussain. Dili is known for his public engagements and his fearless contribution to Muslim conversation and, of course, his editorship of Five Pillars, a very popular online journal. Dili, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah and welcome to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. The honour is all mine and thank you for having me, Jalal Bhai.
Well, look, it's wonderful to have you with us, Dili, and I know that the conversation is a pretty serious one. I've been in conversation with a friend of mine in Bangladesh, and the way he describes it is horrific. I mean, he's taken pictures, photos of dead bodies, of students, of his colleagues, of his peers that have been mowed down by the security services. So it's a very serious situation, and I think not very many of us know enough about it. I haven't been following it, and that's my challenge, really. So let's just start with the basic facts before we talk about the why. I understand that 8,000 student protesters, or possibly more, are currently incarcerated by the security services, and multiples of hundreds have been killed by lethal fire. Is that your understanding of events?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa salam. The situation on the ground, Jalal, is a dire one. I am at fault myself, as someone of Bangladeshi heritage, to have gotten to this late. And the reason why that is because there was an information void to begin with regards to what's actually happening on the ground, the number of deaths and so forth. Now, the figures that you've just stated is what you can say is the kind of official numbers. But then again, who are we referring to when we say official?
Yeah.
Now, Pratham Alom, the most prominent newspaper in Bangladesh, the last I checked, the death toll was 206.
Wow.
The anti-discrimination movement of students who are actually leading these protests against the quota system, they estimate it at least 1,000.
Wow.
At least 1,000. Mostly students.
And it's over a space of a week.
10 to 14 days, right? And I'm saying here, even over 1,000 as in a conservative estimate, Jalal Bhai, that number could potentially be 1,500, 2,000. We just don't know yet. I'll explain to you why.
Yeah.
Mostly students. Teachers also, independent bloggers and journalists, civilians who have nothing to do with these protests.
Yeah.
More than 10,000 either detained or missing, kidnapped, abducted, some taken from hospital beds. As we speak right now, there are Awami League thugs and security forces at all the major hospitals in Dhaka, Rajshahi, Barisal, Bogra, ensuring that the true nature of the number of deaths and injured remains censored. So 206 is nowhere close to the reality. And the anti-discrimination movement saying it's more than 1,000 is purely based on guesstimates and the access to the records that they have. Now, it's interesting that you said a Bashar al-Assad type. It is Assad type.
Yeah.
Mubarak type.
Yeah.
We've seen this before. It's not new when autocratic regimes crack down on popular movements, popular protests against their draconian policies and their corrupt policies.
Yeah.
There's dozens of roadside graves now, Jalal.
Really?
Now you can drive down certain parts of Dhaka now, dozens of roadside graves are popping up. Mm. These are students and civilians, unarmed, that were abducted, killed at night, buried before Fajr, right?
Yes.
This is a situation that we're facing. The counter-argument of the Hasina government or Hasina regime is that this is being organized, orchestrated by her political opposition, primarily the Bangladesh Nationalist Party and Jamaat-e-Islam. This is not something new. We've heard this from her and her regime continuously since 2008 and 2009, since she's been in power since then.
Yeah.
And that's the situation. The situation is that political violence is not new to Bangladesh. It is not new to the Indian subcontinent.
Yes.
Anyone from India or Pakistan or Bangladesh will relate that political thuggery at every section and sector of life is common. But this is bad, Jalal.
Really?
This is really bad, brother. Because, yes, the protest began against the quota system, which we'll go on to discuss.
Yeah.
But now it's become something bigger than that.
Really?
Most definitely. Now it went from radical reforms, revocation of the quota system, now people calling upon Hasina to step down.
Right.
Now, whether that happens willingly is another conversation we can perhaps explore later on in the conversation.
So let's talk about the trigger, the reason why these protests began, because it doesn't sound like, I mean, from an outsider's perspective, it doesn't sound like the trigger was a massive issue. Well, of course, it is a massive issue. And this is the imposition of new quotas on civil service jobs. So my understanding is that the courts passed this 30% rule that the descendants of the 1971 War of Independence would have, in effect, priority for these really plum, important civil service jobs. And in effect, that's what the Awami League members would get the priority. And so why did... And I think it's fair to say, for my reading, what the court says, what Sheikh Hasina and the Awami League say, so there's no difference really between the two. But why? Why did they decide to do that at this moment in time?
So allow me to just go over some important chronology.
Yeah.
The quota system is as old as the People's Republic of Bangladesh. It was introduced to give opportunities in the civil service for discriminated groups of minorities. So that would include 10% for women, 10% for certain districts based on their population, 5% for ethnic and religious minorities, 1% for the disabled.
Yeah.
But the area of contention is the 30% for the freedom fighters or the relatives and the descendants of the freedom fighters. Mm. And let's, viewers and listeners, let them get a grasp of this.
Yeah.
Bangladesh is a nation of 175 million people, the seventh largest in this country, in a country that's the same size as England. Yeah, where 54 to 56% of all civil service jobs are now going to be going to these groups, these underrepresented or discriminated minorities.
Yeah.
This is a huge problem because the disparity between those who are going to further education and employment opportunities, forget about civil service, forget about half-decent private sector jobs, just basic office admin type jobs within the public sector is so scarce. The disparity is outrageous.
Yeah.
In 2018, from popular protests, the quota system was actually revoked. So after 47 years, pretty much, the quota system was abandoned. It was then reinstated in June by a high court, right, to go back to that same quota system.
Yes.
And that is what sparked the initial peaceful protests.
Yeah.
July the 14th, Jalal Bhai, is when things really hit the fan.
Yeah.
Why? Because Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina went on national TV and she said, if the descendants of the freedom fighters don't get these benefits and opportunities, who do you want them to go to? The Razakars? Mm. Now, the Razakars are the traitors or the elements who wanted to remain Pakistan.
Mm.
Those who fought alongside the West Pakistan military, they are those who ideologically or for religious reasons do not believe in an independent Bangladesh,
yeah.
right? They are widely seen, at least in many swathes of Bangladeshi society, as sellouts, agents, traitors, rajakar, right? That angered the students. Because once again, Hasina resorted to the weaponization and the politicization of 1971 to discredit and actually censor these protests. Because most people of Bangladesh, Muslims, irrespective of where they stand politically, have an affinity and a love towards those who fought for the nation. Let's put aside the politics and the history of the event.
Sure.
The way the nation has been conditioned,
yeah.
we revere and respect those who fought for the country, right? So that was a further insult. Because what Hasina does, she plays on the emotions of the people. She knows what independence means to the people. She knows how the people have been conditioned through culture and media, a lot of her doings and that of her father's, right? So to then discredit these popular protests, right, as a bunch of rajakkars, a bunch of sellouts, those who are linked to Jamaat-e-Islam and BNP, right? You basically have made the students a target.
Right.
You've made the students a target because you've equated their cause and what they're calling for to those that are seen as traitors of the country. And July the 14th, when she made those comments to the media, that's when dozens of universities, because it started off with Dhaka University and Jahangirnagar University, another four universities in Dhaka. After July the 14th, dozens of universities then joined the movement in Dhaka, in Barisal, in Rajshahi, in Chittagong, and other parts of the country.
Can you estimate how many people came out from this?
I'm talking, if you were to put all the numbers together across all the different cities and districts, including Dhaka and the major cities I've just mentioned, we're talking easily 100,000 plus. Easy, light work.
Wow.
Light work. 100,000 is nothing for a nation that's 170 million.
Yes.
At least 100,000, if not more. You know, they took to the streets. Also, the issue here was that Dhaka University and Jahangirnagar University colluded with the state authorities to give access to regime thugs and police into university halls and premises, where universities are seen as a sacred place to share ideas. That's certainly not the case in my motherland. So that's the picture. That's the chronology.
Okay.
This is a law that has been in place for as long as Bangladesh. It was revoked in 2018 through peaceful protests. It was reinstated in June this year.
Okay.
And things really escalated once Hasina made those comments about rajakkars.
And why do you think Hasina felt it necessary to reinstate that law, okay, through the courts, and felt it necessary to make those comments? Like, what's happening in the politics for her to do that? Any idea?
So the court system is one of the ways in which the Hasina government and the regime maintain the status quo.
Uh-huh.
At the end of the day, if you get to control 54 to 56% of jobs in civil service, you can pretty much guarantee that your cronies, your thugs, your ideologues, those who have benefited these positions through nepotism are in those offices, right?
Yeah.
It is a way in which you preserve the regime, you preserve the existing status quo. Now, Hasina has been in power since 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
That period between 2009 to 2013, 14 is a very critical period which we're going to discuss, as in, how come she's been left there in power for 15 years without challenge?
Yes.
Well, we look at what resulted in that and who the opposition are and some of their shortcomings, right? Which are many, by the way. So the quota system is a way in which the regime, and let's be honest about it, the BNP have done this before as well.
Mm-hmm.
When they have had terms in power, they too have used this to put their people into power.
Goodness.
Not so much as the Awami League, but they've never enjoyed the amount of years in power as the Awami League and Sheikh Hasina has.
Yes.
But the quota system is one way in which you maintain and preserve the regime because you're putting your key people into these positions, 54 to 56%.
Right.
Now,
and why is that really significant in a country like Bangladesh? Like, what is it about these civil service jobs that marks those jobs to be better than other jobs around?
So, you know, in the West, and including the UK, we're talking about a rising cost of living.
Mm.
in Bangladesh and Pakistan, and the reason why I coined Pakistan and India into this is because there's a historical heritage, there's a historical geopolitical history behind this, because we're going to talk about the events of 1971, as in, like, why does she always politicize this? Yeah. We're going to talk about the role of India and its relationship with Bangladesh. So I will always coin them into this generalization.
Yeah.
And that is because these jobs, right, they are to do with not a rising cost of living, it's to do with the cost of surviving, Jalal Bhai. Mm. The conversation in Bangladesh is not about the rising cost of living. It's the cost of surviving. It's the cost of being able to have more than one meal a day. Mm. It's the cost of being able to have electric and clean water, right? Many of the thousands of the students that are protesting come from all walks of life, socioeconomically. Some of them come from educated families, middle-class families. Others are the children of farmers and from the rural areas of Bangladesh. These jobs are so important because whilst the official unemployment stat is somewhere around 4 to 4.5%, the actual unemployment percentage of Bangladesh, if you factor in the jobs that are being taken, what they're being paid, and what the standard figure is to survive on a day-to-day basis, is somewhere around 12%.
Wow.
That's horrendous,
yeah.
Right? And these civil service jobs, you're set for life. A decent salary, and then a pension till the day you die. Potentially your families will benefit as well. So it's like a never-ending kind of like benefit. And it's so important because in a country where jobs generally are so scarce, jobs within the civil service in, you know, central and local government are so crucial for these graduates. And then we talk about why is there brain drain in the Ummah? Why then we talk about why do people from these countries go to the Middle East to do jobs which don't match what they have qualified for in their respective countries?
Yeah.
That's why the quota system is so important for those two primary reasons, but there are others. One is to preserve and maintain the regime because you get to choose who are in these positions. The Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Media and Culture, the Ministry of Information, right? Education, schools, universities, colleges, telecoms, army, police, RAB, the NSI. Every aspect, every sector of the state apparatus, low level to high level, this is what the quota system preserves. And number two, it is because that the quota system itself is something that has been weaponized by different governments because it's just a way in which you get your people into power.
You said earlier on that the protests are broadened. So it's no longer really about the quota system.
No.
So where has it broadened to?
So let's talk about the demands.
But there is a leadership to this movement.
There is. I mean, even one of the leaders, Nahid Islam, who is one of the prominent leaders of this movement, is currently under arrest, being detained. One of the demands of the protest is to actually release him and other members.
Right.
But let's actually go through the list. And
he's a student.
He's a student, yes. Right. Nahid Islam.
Yeah.
And there are many others.
Yeah.
The Prime Minister must apologize to the nation for the killing of students and she must step down.
Mm-hmm.
The resignation of the Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan Kamal and Road Transport and Brigades Minister Obeidul Qadir. Number three, dismissal of the Deputy Inspector General, Police Commissioner and Superintendent of Police in areas where students have been killed. The resignation of the Vice Chancellor of Dhaka University, Jahangir University and Rajshahi University. Number five, arrest and prosecution of police officers and ruling party thugs accused of student killings. Number six, the families of the grieving and the deceased to be compensated. Number seven, prohibition of partisan student politics on all campuses.
Mm.
Number eight, all schools, colleges and universities and student halls should be reopened again for students. Number nine, guarantee that a student's participation in the protest does not cause any harm to their academic future.
These are brave words.
These are brave words.
Yeah.
Now, Paul, our mutual brother and friend, asked me, how much of that do you think is going to actually be delivered?
Mm-hmm.
I said, are you asking me what I think or what I hope and pray for?
Yeah.
I think none of it will be delivered. Right. I pray and hope that they're all delivered, inshallah.
Yeah.
Now, the protests went from a revocation and or a radical reform of the quota system, right? So there were even discussions about reducing it to 5%.
Yeah.
But now it's gone to Hasina needs to step down.
Mm.
That's what it's got to.
And how widespread do you think that type of understanding would hold? I mean, you know, is the student movement, because that's a brave position to have.
And very.
We'll come to the repression, but it seems to me that you know, there's one thing arguing that the quota system needs to be reformed, and there's another thing calling for the downing of the prime minister and the government. You know, do you think that's going to maintain, that line will be maintained by these students? Is there enough bravery and courage, dare I say, out there to maintain that line?
I think it would be, it wouldn't be correct to say that things before these protests were hunky-dory, Chimalbai. They weren't, right? And many have been asking, is the quota system that crucial that it has led to now protests calling for the downfall of the regime?
Yeah.
Look, let's be serious. Corruption, cost of surviving, unemployment, poverty. Bangladeshis are generally fed up of Hasina's rule.
Yeah.
It's been 15 years.
Yeah.
Tens of millions are of this opinion, but I'd also be lying if she didn't have popular support either in certain areas. But how would she not?
Yeah.
If you have a system like the quota system and you rule with reign and terror,
yeah,
of course you're going to have loyalists. And there are Awami League popular support. Many Bangladeshi Silatis from the UK who will listen to this podcast know they have them within their own families. I have Awami League members in my own family, Chimalbai, right? It goes from the inner cities of Dhaka into the tentacles of the rural villages of Sylhet and other parts of the country.
Right.
Now, I say this because the call for Hasina to step down has been a sentiment that's always existed amongst large swathes of Bangladeshis who are not pro-Hasina, who are not pro-Awami League. Now, of course, her supporters and backers will have a completely different perspective, right? We've, for those who don't know, Sheikh Hasina is the daughter of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, the founding father of the Republic. She, when she speaks and she makes accusations or weaponized in 1971, she does so knowing that that is her status and that's how she's perceived. So, the downfall of Hasina to come down, is it likely? Highly unlikely. But that's also the reason why the crackdown has been so brutal. Whenever the calls of protest have been for her to step down, that is when she turns it up a notch. And to the extent where now every single apparatus, armed apparatus and bodies within the Bangladeshi government are involved in the killing of protesters. We're talking about rapid action battalion forces. We're talking about the equivalent of the FBI and MI5 of Bangladesh, the NSI. We are talking about police, we are talking about army, we are talking about brigadiers. Look at the extent in which she is so concerned about preserving her kursi, right? So is the call for Hasina to step down a popular one? Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what the whole cementing of her power between 2009, 2013 or 14 was about. You know, the elimination and the hanging of Jamaati leaders and BNP leaders, the lifetime imprisonment that was handed down to Dilwar Hussain Sayyidi and others, the very popular Jamaati Islam orator and preacher. You know, the fact that in 2014, even though I think this was a mistake, Bangladesh Nationalist Party boycotted the elections. The deregulation of Jamaati Islam to take part in the national elections because they put God over democratic elections. This was one of the reasons that was cited. So 2009 to 2013 was a critical period where she cemented this power. Mm. The call for Hasina to step down and for the for the country to have a new government, right, is a popular one.
Yeah.
But I'd be wrong to say that she herself does not have elements of support that also number many.
I mean, can you speak to this overwhelming force then that's been employed by the Hasina government? And talk about what, I mean, maybe I'm pronouncing wrong, but Chhatra League. This is a student group of the Awami League.
Yes.
And how, almost like a paramilitary group, and how they've been quite instrumental in mowing down some of these student protesters.
So Chhatra League is the student wing of Awami League. Chhatra Dal is the student wing of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party.
The opposition.
Yeah. And Chhatra Shibir is the student wing of Jamaati Islam.
Okay.
These are the three main big players in Bangladeshi politics. In the last 15 years, not so much. Why is student wings so integral to the preservation of the status quo and the regime?
Yeah.
It's because they control schools, they control colleges, they control universities.
Yeah.
They preserve the regime by censoring dissent, whether their activism is Islamic or secular. They, with intimidation and violence, they prevent opposition groups from organizing at university campuses and colleges. They mobilize armed thugs. They bully and intimidate teachers and professors. they are also involved in actual crime, whether it be extortion and racketeering and ransom and kidnappings and, you know, stolen goods and weapons. Political parties in the Indian subcontinent, jailed by other mafia.
Mm-hmm.
In Bangladesh, the student wings, and especially Chhatra League, are like the Shabiha of Hasina.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, why is that so important? It's because when you're dealing with a population that's so large, you need to have a grip on colleges, universities, schools especially, but also other public sectors. This is also grounded around the idea that Mawlana Abu Ala al-Mawdudi, rahimahullah, in his early works about how to revive the Islamic spirit politically, he spoke in great detail about how Muslims, God-fearing people of taqwa, need to access these civic society institutions and bring change from ground up. So taking that same thinking, Awami League knows how important schools, universities and colleges are for two reasons. For indoctrination, for recruitment, number 3, but also to censor any type of mobilization or organization against the regime.
Right.
I've just explained to you, those things don't sound like that activity of student wings, do they? Racketeering, extortion, kidnappings, sexual assaults, battery, murder. They're involved in all of that. Now, supporters of Hasina will say, oh, well, Chhatra Dal does the same and Chhatra Shibir, you know, cuts the heels of their victims and, you know, they do kidnapping, they do the same things. I'm sure they do. I'm not disputing that. But we've not had that for 15 years. We're talking about a situation in the last 15 years. Yeah. And Chhatra League thugs and goons, they can be students. They can be they can be members of university sports teams. They could be the local guy who owns the tea shop in the bazaar.
Yeah.
He could be in the halls. They are planted and they are present everywhere. And they are spies. They are thugs. They are criminals. Some of them are educated. Some of them, believe it or not, could even be religious. They come in all stripes and colors. And they rule with a reign of terror, fear and intimidation. And again, it is one of the ways in which whichever party is, keeps control in that campus, that area. It's not uncommon to hear when you go to Bangladesh, so who runs this university? Who runs this college? And they'll tell you the top boys are Shibir. The top boys are Chhatra League. The top boys are, these days, it's mainly Chhatra League, right? Pre-2009, pre-2008, before the military rule and all that stuff, there used to be equal playing fields in certain areas and districts.
This is a Jamaat uni.
So for example, Jamaat Islam is very popular in Chittagong, right? The BNP is very popular in Bogra, right? So naturally, there will be loyalists and supporters in there. But for the last 15 years, Chhatra League have ruled and dominated these campuses with impunity, committing crimes on a daily basis, which actually got underreported and actually not discussed as often.
Yeah.
And that's why political violence and thuggery, especially in educational institutions, is so important, again, for the preservation of the regime. Because ultimately, Jalbar, we're talking about we're not just talking about Hasina here. We're talking about from the breadth of the Muslim world, from Morocco to Indonesia, as north as the Caucasus to as south as Tanzania. What do regimes do to preserve the status quo, to preserve their kursi? And one of the ways in which it happens in the Indian subcontinent and mainly in Bangladesh is through court system, student wing violence, amongst other ways in which they do it.
Right, that's really, really, I think, interesting. So Sheikh Hasina is trying to solidify and preserve her power. I mean, is there now an opposition in Bangladesh? I mean, you know, you talk about the BNP and you talk about Jamaat.
Yeah.
Do they really provide a viable opposition anymore? Has she succeeded over the last 15, 16 years to just expunge, you know, these political forces from society?
This is no longer about her solidifying. Yeah. It's about preserving. The period of solidification was between 2008, 2009 to 2014.
Oh, really?
So 2014 was the general election in which, the first general election which Jamaat-e-Islam was not allowed to participate in as Jamaat-e-Islam.
Yes.
They were legally deregulated, or they basically had to just disband.
Really?
Yeah, they weren't allowed. Okay. Even now in local district and union elections, Jamaati guys have to stand up as independents, right? Mm. The period of solidification was 2009, 2014. So let's just go over some of these events. These are just a handful of events, right? 2013, Hifazat Islam, which is the largest apolitical Diobandi group, made mainly of ulama, imams, Hufadh al-Quran, Tulab al-Ilm. They protested in Shapla Square against caricatures of the Prophet ﷺ, and they wanted to introduce within the constitution what Westerners would describe as a blasphemy law, but they wanted to basically outlaw any, you know, gratuitous insults against the Prophet ﷺ, which is what atheist, Hindu and secular bloggers and journalists were doing under the patronage of the Awami League.
Right.
This, in 2013, at night, hundreds were massacred.
Really?
Hundreds. We're talking about young Tulab, Jalal Bhai, 13, 14, 15-year-old
and
kids.
It was just peaceful protest?
It was a peaceful sit-in.
Yeah?
Peaceful sit-in. Electric was cut, internet was cut, and they were massacred in the night. Now, the official number's 50 or 60, but again, we're talking hundreds here, right? 2013, 2015, we haven't discussed this. She even set up her own kangaroo court, the International Crimes Tribunal. This was a court that she set up, right? Or the Bangladeshi authorities set up. And ultimately, it was just there to eliminate and literally kill popular political opposition. Imagine that. And by the way, the UN did not recognize this International Crimes Tribunal. They wanted external monitors to come in. Not that we're saying the UN is any standard to go by, but let's just, if we're going to talk about the language of international community and international validity, they did not allow external monitors to come and look at the due process, the legal process of how cases are measured, how, what evidence have been produced and so forth. So the International Crimes Tribunal eliminated the following leaders. Dilwar Hussain Saidi was given a lifetime imprisonment, perhaps one of the most popular speakers who has cross-society support. He was given a lifetime prison sentence. He died in 2023. Abdul Qadir Mullah, senior Jamaati leader, hanged in 2013. In August 2013, Jamaat was banned from participating in general election. 2014, the BNP boycotted the general election. I think this was a mistake. 2015, Salahuddin Qadir Chowdhury, a senior BNP leader and figurehead, and Ali Ahsan Mujahid were hung. We're talking about a dictator who literally set up her own court to now judge on who is guilty of what happened in 1971. And look at the period in which she weaponized the ICT. She did it between 2009 to 2014. With the final executions around 2015. This was Hasina telling the people of Bangladesh one message and one message alone. You get on the wrong side of me and this government, you could be tried at this court.
Right.
Or you could be tried at any court of my choice in this land. And this period of solidification, which she has done so successfully, I would say, was between 2008 and 2014, because 2014 elections where Jamaat was not allowed to participate and the BNP boycotted it, there was no opposition. Now, who are the opposition? Bangladesh Nationalist Party. Now, are these guys angels? Are these guys good? No. No. Because just because they oppose Awami League and Sheikh Hasina does not mean that they are the viable opposition. It can be argued that they are the only opposition. And whenever they have come to power or enjoyed some years in power, it has been done through coalitions with the assistance of Jamaat-e Islam. Jalal Bhai, there's been times in Bangladeshi history where Jamaat-e Islam had to make alliances with Awami League. You know? And this is just the nature of secular politics, right? And not necessarily that's one that's inclining towards Islam or true justice. This is what we find in many parts of the Muslim majority world, right? Where putting the kind of the monarchies and the, you know, kind of absolute monarchies aside, we have this facade of a multi-party system, which Muslim countries think they can emulate from the West, right? They think that you can have a Republican Democratic system. And even these systems are being questioned pretty much every year. We've just had a general election here. There is so much criticism of the people. There is so much voter apathy. So these models that you want to replicate, which are actually post-colonial models that were left. These were systems that were left by the colonizer. If you actually go into the constitutions of Bangladesh, even Pakistan and India, you'll find the actual skeleton is a colonial skeleton of the constitution. It's a colonial one.
Yeah.
So the Bangladesh Nationalist Party ideologically are not as pro-India, not as pro-India as the Awami League. They are also brutal and repressive against their political opponents. They too have committed injustice and dhulm against Awami League students, Awami League supporters, those who are not actually guilty of any crimes but have been collectively punished when they've been in power.
Yeah.
You have Jamaat-e Islam, who has had a similar journey like the Muslim Brotherhood has. I'm talking in very broad general terms here because I know time is of the essence.
It's become less ideological.
Yes, less ideological. Very pragmatic. Very pragmatic, yeah. Excessively pragmatic. Mm. At times, naively and delusionally pragmatic. Yeah, right?
Common.
Yeah. But Jamaat-e Islam in Bangladesh is stronger than Jamaat-e Islam in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Is stronger than Jamaat-e Islam in India or occupied Kashmir. Mm. Jamaat-e Islam in Bangladesh is the strongest of the wings within the Indian subcontinent because they had popular support. This was the party that introduced free healthcare in certain areas where they had heavy influence, introduced Sharia banking, Islamic education. They've done a lot for civil society and have always done very well organized. Mm. People that in the early years were trusted, were seen as people, 1971 happened, you guys were wrong, as in like they're critics, but they have done good for society.
Mm.
But as years went by, wanting to seek a position on the table of power has meant major compromises, right? Which has, invited criticisms from even other conservative Islamic groups. We've seen this with Erdogan in Turkey, when he had to ally with right-wing nationalists, right? Borderlining Turkish supremacists, right? We've seen this in other parts of the Muslim world where we've seen it with Al-Nahda, when they thought, they were going to win democratically, but we saw what happened, right? So this kind of like, I don't want to say delusional, because delusion would mean, I think it's a term that's not healthy when speaking of brothers and groups and movements who I believe at the core have good intentions. But
naive
would be more accurate. Yeah. And so what Bangladeshis have seen from Jamaat-e Islam, who are the depiction of Islam in politics, whether we want to admit it or not, when people think of Islamic politics, they think of Ikhwan al-Muslimin in the Arab world, or they think of Jamaat-e Islam in the Indian subcontinent.
Sure.
Now, the problem with that is that whenever there has been, inexcusable compromises in policies, when they have had opportunities to rule or they've had influence within the parliament, that means now people have also lost trust in them. I don't believe that the Bangladeshi Jamaat can be compared to the Pakistani Jamaat because Bangladeshi Jamaat still has a lot of popular support. The Bangladesh Nationalist Party has popular support. But are they a viable and beneficial alternative to the Awami League? At this present moment in time, I think the sentiments of tens of millions, especially the protesters, is anyone but Hasina.
Right.
At this present moment in time, we're not talking about viable opposition. They're talking about we've had enough. Hasina needs to step down.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we're at.
Muslim teenagers face many challenges. A myth is peddled that following Islam makes life difficult and they'll be happier if they were less religious. But rather than reject religion, I want to offer a new point of view. In my book, Smart Teenage Muslimah, I invite girls to look at the ideas and behaviours that wider society expects them to embrace and decide whether they are good for their mental health and well-being. Concepts such as self-obsession, rampant consumerism, and feminism. Inshallah, to find out more, visit www.smartmuslimah.com. The book is now available to buy on Amazon and Google Play Books.
Earlier on, you talked about the relationship between the Awami League and the Indian government.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that there's a very close relationship with the BJP and Modi's government and Sheikh Hasina. Can you expand on that? Like, what is behind that relationship? Because someone said to me, and, I'm not sure how accurate it is, it's almost a master-slave relationship. I don't know if that's going too far, but explain the dynamics of that relationship, please.
Well, let's first set out some kind of like, again, I say this because I do believe there is still some, just a lack of education about Bangladesh.
Mm.
It's geopolitics, it's history.
I know nothing about
it. Because people know about partition and Indian Pakistan.
Yes.
But they don't understand how integral and how very much so Bangladesh and East Pakistan prior to that was a part of this post-British Empire, British Raj partition.
Yes.
Right? Hasina, or whichever government or party is in power, needs India for their survival.
Yeah.
Hasina has to have this relationship with India because it is part of the survival of her regime. Raw agents and other pro-India elements are embedded within every sector of the state apparatus. Now, people think that's outrageous. No, there are Indian agents within the very fabric and apparatus of government institutions in Bangladesh. Every central government body, ministry, the army, security forces, police, RAB. Yeah. You know, we talk about Pakistan's deep state or the Turkish deep state. Bangladesh's deep state, it can be argued, is India.
Really?
The deep state of Bangladesh, as we know of it for the last 15 years at least, and some would argue since the inception. Because remember, India is seen by many in Bangladesh as the one who aided us for our liberation and independence war.
Right.
Of course, that's far from the truth. India was the biggest benefactor from the civil war between West and East Pakistan.
Yeah.
They benefited greatly. It was a military nightmare to have two Pakistans in your East and Western flank. God forbid that they ever accrued military capabilities. The reconquest of India or Hindu-majority India was not beyond the realms of possibilities. This was India's nightmare, irrespective if it was Congress Party or the BJP.
Yeah.
Right. So the relationship with the Modi government and India generally, irrespective of even before the BJP came into power, even with the Congress Party, is one of survival. Things periodically and perceptibly differed when, let's say, BNP were in power or when there was a military junta in power in Bangladesh, where there has been times like that. And during the Congress rule in India is not that different to BJP rule in India in terms of how things are impacted in Bangladesh. Mm. Sure, when the BNP were in power, their rhetoric would be less pro-India and more pro-independence, perhaps at times even pro-Pakistan or exploring other avenues. But it is still very much reliant on India. Why? Because if you think Bangladesh is this fist, India covers it like this in terms of border. Yeah. To the east, north and west, 80%, I think, of the border, Bangladesh is surrounded by India. It shows a tiny border with Myanmar in the southeast. It is so reliant at the moment, by the choice of those who govern and rule over the country.
Yeah.
It is heavily reliant, the economy is, imports and exports with India. India needs Bangladesh to never ever be Islamic, to never ever explore anything beyond Indian dependency. And I say this because we now have to look at China in this equation. India needs a Bangladesh that is close, that will not be tempted by the financial slavery of China, which many Muslim countries have fallen to. It is in India's favor to keep Bangladesh as a vessel state. That's what it is. Bangladesh is a vessel state, sadly.
Right.
And I know that might be a hard pill to swallow, but that's the reality. The reality is foreign policy especially is heavily influenced, if dare I say dictated, by Delhi, right? But at a minimal, at the bare minimum, the dependency in which successive Bangladeshi governments have relied on India has basically made it perhaps not a slave and master relationship, but certainly a vessel relationship, whereby we're here now in a situation where if India was to cut off certain trade deals or certain trade routes, or if they decided to release the water from the dam and flood Bangladesh at will, which they have done historically, they can. It's just that successive Bangladeshi governments, including the opposition, have never thought of a Bangladesh without India, have never actually in a meaningful way tried, even remotely tried, to move away from the dependency of India. But let's talk about some of the things which Hasina and Modi have in common.
Yeah.
It's very important to discuss this. Modi and BJP and Hasina and Awami League are ardently ideologically nationalists. They are both united in their hatred for political Islam and Pakistan.
Right.
They pull on the string of their people, on the hearts and the strings of their people around the war on terror and CVE narrative of Islamist radicals and terrorists and extremists and fifth columns and people who are traitors. Modi does this with Muslims. BJP does this with Muslims, has done this with Muslims since they've been in power. And in fact, the Congress Party have done it in their own more subtle ways as well. Yeah. Hasina does the same. She uses the narrative and the language, the jingoistic language of the war on terror, right? Politicizing 1971 in the same way that Modi does with 1948 and the Mughal period. He goes all the way back then. So they have that in common. They have this in common, that they have dealings with Israel. Lest we forget that the Al Jazeera done an expose whereby elements loyal to Hasina and the Bangladeshi army were buying spyware from Israel, right? We know that military hardware and weapons have been sold to Israel from India, right? So they have that in common. They have their closeness to the UAE leadership in common. We know that, I think, 57 or 54 Bangladeshis were arrested and detained for protesting against the quota system. And this was mainly not out on the streets with placards. These are social media posts, Jalal Bhai. Mm-hmm. So the Modi regime and the Hasina regime have all of this in common. And they also play on the distortion of history, which is India was the savior of East Pakistan in 1971. And that Bangladeshis and Bangladesh need India as the older brother, as the Barabai, to look after our affairs. We rely on them so. In fact, as Bangladeshi, what Hasina and her supporters will present to the people is, how can you think of a future without India?
Yeah.
It's not even possible. It's not possible. There's even this, you know, narrative that we will forever be indebted to India because of their help in 1971. Yeah. So slave master, vessel overlord, whatever language makes you happy, what you need to know is Bangladesh is not independent in its fiscal policies, in its domestic policies, in its foreign policies, and that elements that are actually Indian or pro-India are embedded within the very structures of the Bangladeshi state.
I've spoken to a number of people prior to this programme, asking them for advice, maybe even looking for guests for this programme from different angles. And there is a general fear, even here in Britain, to talk against the Hasina regime. Now, of course, you don't seem to have that. But what's behind that fear? And actually, as I'm on the subject of the UK, we have got a MP here in the UK. We, meaning in Britain, we have an MP, Tulip Siddiq.
Yes.
Who's the niece of Sheikh Hasina.
Yep.
So just talk to that. Like, what is the relationship between Tulip Siddiq and the Bangladeshi government? And also there's just general fear I witness where people are willing to have private conversations, but they're not really ready to put their neck on the line. But what's going on there?
There's three things you asked. Let's get Tulip Siddiq out of the way first. Tulip Siddiq is the maternal niece of Sheikh Hasina, Sheikh Hasina's sister's daughter, a Zionist, pro-Israel, has never really spoken out for the people of her motherland and her heritage. She's had years of opportunities to speak on behalf of Bangladeshis and to advocate for them, and the continuous ongoing repression and human rights abuses done under not only her aunt, but also the governments that ruled and governed before that, so BNP and Jamaat.
Yeah.
Tulip Siddiq has generally taken a kind of silent approach to domestic Bangladeshi issues and how she advocates for it here.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at the optics of it, Jalal Bhai. This is her actual niece who's now part of the ruling government in the UK. Yeah. There's absolutely no way, if Tulip had an ounce of sincerity in her, an ounce of care for her, whether she sees them as countrymen or people of their motherland, she would have spoken out by now. She does so. She remains silent purposely, by choice, because her silence is also a way in which soft power and soft diplomacy is utilised. Now, are there any official links between Tulip Siddiq and the Awami League? No, but it is a known thing that senior Awami League activists and members, you know, move very closely around her during the 2017 elections, the 2019 elections. Awami League members from East London went and helped Tulip Siddiq. At least this is something that's widely discussed on the grassroots level. Tulip Siddiq's links and lines of communication with her aunt are open, very direct. She has the support of Awami League members, supporters, ideologues in the UK. Are there any formal links or financial links? That's something that is yet to be proven. But the affiliation and association is there. She supports her aunt. She supports, you know, whatever's happening by choice of her silence.
Yeah.
Because if we're going to say that, look, what's happening in Bangladesh, not just with these recent protests, but generally what's happened in the country since 2008 and 2009, she had all these opportunities to at least pretend some kind of neutrality or impartiality, but she has just remained silent. We remember of the very famous incident some years ago when a Channel 4 presenter asked Tulip Siddiq, here you are protesting for a British teacher being held in a jail in Iran. What about these British Bangladeshis that are being imprisoned in Bangladesh under the regime of your aunt? She literally threatened the Channel 4 presenter. Yeah. She was pregnant at the time. She had to apologize for that. Yeah. So that's the kind of person we're talking about. Yeah. I don't think we should hold our breath much on Tulip Siddiq saying or doing much.
Yeah.
That said, we should continuously remind the Bangladeshi community, the Muslim community, and the wider British public that we have currently, as a member of parliament, a voted member of parliament who has direct links, perhaps the most closest of all the links to any autocratic regimes that any British politician has to date as of now, 2024, is Tulip Siddiq. And her ongoing silence, it can only be seen as support for her aunt and the way in which she's dealing with this issue.
And the fear that Bangladesh is here seem to face.
Now, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, people who have businesses, people who go to colleges, people who have relatives back home. When I said to you that student wing violence or political thuggery and violence is present in pretty much every aspect of society, it's present, it's there, it's in the bazaar, it's in the shopping malls. Meaning there are pro-regime thugs and goons everywhere in society. They're in your local mosque, they're in your local village, they're in everywhere. Now, the reason why people don't want to talk about it are obvious. They're scared. They do not want to get kidnapped. They don't want to get beaten. They don't want anything to happen to their family members. They don't want any heat coming to them here or in Bangladesh. But let's look at a document that was sent out to all heads of missions from the Bangladeshi government. Yeah. I'm just going to read out some bits, but it's so important because it's directly linked to what we spoke about.
Yeah.
So, to all Bangladeshi missions abroad, this is an official document from the Foreign Secretary to heads of missions. And I'm just going to highlight what he is saying to the official diplomats as well as Awami League supporters and members. I'm sure all of you are doing your best to use these materials as appropriate. However, the ministry would be happy to receive your specific feedback, among others, on the following points. Whether you could reach the host government to brief on the current situation in Bangladesh, what was their initial reaction, if any? What can we do more to convince of the events taking place in Bangladesh? Is there any local media reports on the issue and were there any negative narratives on the situation in Bangladesh? Were the mission attempted to engage editors, sub-editors, desk reporters to portray the real scenario on the ground? Is there any demonstrations in support of the student call to reform movement, either in your host country or accredited country? Are there any local think tanks or civil society organizations that are willing to give a lending ear to what's happening, what's truly happening in Bangladesh? Now we're getting to the interesting bits. Where the local diaspora who are favorably disposed have been discreetly utilized to boost counter narratives among the local diaspora. The main challenge seems to be controlling the narratives in social media. X, WhatsApp, YouTube, Facebook. If there is any effective way to tackle this, please share this with us. This is the Foreign Secretary of the seventh largest country in the world, the fourth largest Muslim country in the world, sending this email out to all its diplomats in embassies and constituencies that, look, guys, if there's any way in which we can kind of fake support for the regime, if there's any way in which we can target those who are speaking out, and if there's any way in which we can further censor the diaspora on these platforms. Lastly, the mission may have specific suggestions which could be useful in the coming days to face. This has gone out, if you can see. It's an official document that's gone out to all the heads of missions. This is not normal.
No.
This is literally textbook dictatorial types of cons, right? Because not only are you talking about trying to win over the PR for your situation, you're now literally talking about how to target diaspora communities. Again, this is not new. China does this with the Uyghurs who speak out. Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad and Saddam have done this in the past to British citizens and diaspora communities here. So there's nothing different or new that Hasina is doing, but this only further proves where she's at in terms of popular support and how much scared she is. How scared she is of the popular protests that have now gone from the quota system to now having to step down. So given that these are the type of emails that are being sent out by the head of state, the foreign secretary, you can now imagine the tentacles of influence of the regime in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in the United States, in Italy, in countries where there are large Bangladeshi diaspora communities. I think there was a brother online, he's a human rights activist, Sultan Mohammed Zakaria. He even put out like a notice for any diaspora community members that have been targeted or threatened by Awami League supporters. There are messages that are being posted by Awami League members on social media. I saw a senior member in Spain saying that, can you tag the profiles of people who have been criticizing the Hasina government? So there's eyes and ears of the regime on the streets of London, on the streets of Italy, the US and other parts of the Western world.
Yeah.
And this is why people are scared to speak up. Now, as to why am I speaking up? It's a religious duty. I see the situation in Bangladesh is no different to that of Gaza in the sense that I have a religious duty to speak out. Of course, there's a further affinity because this is the nation of my heritage. But people are scared, Jalal, by it. You can just get kidnapped in the bazaar. You can get kidnapped in the airport. The famous charity fundraiser, Rizwan Hussain, barrister Rizwan Hussain, who people see on their TV screens. You know, you'd think that, you know, a respected barrister, you know, educated, a TV personality for those, for Bengali communities, was battered in the airport, punched up and arrested and battered in the airport by government forces.
Yeah.
You know, this happened some years ago, but I'm just trying to show you the impunity in which this government, this regime acts. So people are scared. The straight answer is no different to why any other diaspora communities refuse to speak out about these issues. It's because they're scared. Now, the elements that affiliate themselves to Jamaat-e-Islam or BNP, many of whom are in exile, the leaders in exile, they will talk out because they talk from the comforts of their life in the West.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, complaining, you know, protesting, discussing in private is one thing. To speak out against the Hasina regime on social media can result in death, kidnapping, arrest, family members being, you know, hurt and targeted in Bangladesh. So the silence is understandable. But I think the situation has now gone beyond the quota system and it actually requires people that are not affiliated to the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, people that are not affiliated to Jamaat-e-Islam, you know, people of conscience, people of justice, Bangladeshis of all stripes and colours and walks of life to come out and now ultimately support the students and support their main call. And their main call at this present moment in time is for her to stand down.
One final question for you, Dilia. And really, this has been a fascinating conversation, really thorough and very detailed. International outrage, we don't see it, right?
Yeah.
There's not very much going on internationally. I mean, this is pretty horrific, what you've described on the streets of Dhaka and other cities in Bangladesh yet. There doesn't seem to be that level of anger towards what's happening there. I mean, why do you think the international community remains pretty tight-lipped?
Let's talk about the international community, but let's also talk about the Muslim community. We'll speak about the Muslim, but the international community, let's address that first. Generally speaking, the world is focused on other things.
Yeah.
They're focused on Israel and Gaza. They are focused on Ukraine.
Yeah.
Therefore, the leading countries have been focused on their own domestic general elections, France, the UK, America in November. So attention has been focusing elsewhere for these respective governments who are perceived as the leading nations of the international community.
Yeah.
They've just been busy. They've been busy with stuff in their own backyard.
Sure.
But it's also to do with the fact that Bangladesh, for whatever reason, doesn't get the same precedent or importance as, let's say, India and Pakistan does. And understandably so, because when you talk about India and Pakistan, you talk about two nuclear nations, that the brink of war is ever so present. It can be, whether it's just, you know, hot air or not, the actual prospects of it is there. So Bangladesh always get the hard end of the deal when it comes to international attention. And that's because there is a lack of education about the role and the position of Bangladesh in the wider history of the Indian subcontinent. I'm a firm believer, and this goes to Muslims and non-Muslims, to truly understand what is happening in a region, understand its heritage, understand even a cursory level, its history. So the international community is busy. It's busy with other things, and therefore Bangladesh doesn't get that attention. But there's another issue here. The international community and the UN specifically understands fully how deeply embedded and endemic corruption is in Bangladesh, from bottom to the highest level. There were attempts by UN representatives back in 2008 or 9 before that to mediate between the BNP and the Awami League. There were efforts by the UN in 2014 to urge the Bangladesh Nationalist Party to take part in the elections, saying that, look, okay, fine, you don't trust the process, at least participate in it. They have kind of concluded that, look, Bangladesh is somewhat of a lost cause, because who's the opposition? Who is the opposition? And in all honesty, is it not better to have a strong woman or a strong armor dictator like Hasina to keep things in order,
right,
than for things to go up in air and for there to be nationwide strikes and hartals and potentially civil unrest that could potentially lead to a military rule?
But do you think they can't perceive, or they willfully are blind to the fact that a woman as a leader could be a dictator?
That could be in the mind of many, but you'd be deluded to think that. Why can't a female be a dictator?
Yeah.
If it can even be argued, just in some areas, in some aspects, there could be worse dictators. We saw that with the Bhutto regime, right? Mm. But I just think, and I'm sorry to just simplify like this, I just don't think it's the top priority.
They don't care.
They just don't care.
Yeah.
You know, if you put the list of countries which the international community do care about, mm-hmm. it would be the conflict in the occupation of, in occupied Palestine.
Yeah.
It would be key strategic countries like Egypt and Turkey,
yeah.
and oil-rich monarchies of the Gulf.
Yeah.
Pakistan, for different reasons, because of its close ties with America, essentially being a garrison state for the US.
Yeah.
But Bangladesh, sadly and simply, just doesn't yield that importance amongst the international community whilst contributing towards UN peacekeeping forces and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's the truth of it, Jalalbhai. There is no deep answer behind why there's been minimal attention or outrage from the international community. There's an element of they've been preoccupied with more important things domestically and abroad.
Yeah.
Secondly, they just don't see Bangladesh on the same level or a threat to international security within that region,
yeah.
as India and Pakistan. And thirdly, they just don't really care, because they don't really see Bangladesh up there as a nation in which their affairs should be focused on. Because remember, for the international community to care, Jalalbhai, there needs to be an interest for them.
Yeah.
Right? You know, as the host of the Thinking Muslim podcast, you've had so many, you know, celebrated thinkers and analysts here. The international community, when you're talking about Britain, France, America, NATO, UN, these bodies only talk when there's a vested interest for them to preserve, or when they're trying to prevent something from happening.
Mm.
At this present moment in time, there's nothing there in Bangladesh that urges them to take a position or a strong position.
Yeah.
And that's the truth of it. They should care, because they're talking about the seventh largest country in the world. They should care because many Western economies rely on Bangladesh for rice, for clothes, for labor. So you should care. As for the Muslims are focused on Gaza.
Yeah.
Do you know what the beautiful thing about the student protests in Bangladesh, Jalalbhai, is that they know we're focused on Gaza. They know we're focused on Gaza. The many emails and messages I've received, it has nearly started with, and look at this, so many started with, Brother Dili, Assalamu Alaikum, I know the Ummah's focused on Gaza.
Mm.
I've had so many of these messages, but please, by talk about us. Please, by share this. Please, by can you urge this person to share this? Just retweet us. Just do something. We know everyone's focused on Gaza. We're not likening our oppression to theirs in terms of the barbarity, right? But it's bad here.
Yeah.
And never have we called upon our brothers and sisters beyond Bangladesh to be our eyes and ears. You know, the cutting of internet for 6 days, we know when regimes do that, what that means. They're trying to prevent information from going out to the world. You know that a massacre is about to go down, if not already has started. This is textbook, autocratic, dictatorial, you know, regimes do this, right? So the Muslim Ummah needs to be concerned with what's happening in Bangladesh, because 1 in 10 Muslim on earth is from Bangladesh. The second language that's spoken by Muslims after Arabic is Bengali. These are, for those of us in the UK, who does the activism for Palestine and for all these causes?
Yeah.
It's nearly always British Bangladeshi or British Pakistani. I'm talking about the legwork.
Yeah.
That, you know, the legwork, the doing, the administration, the organizing, the mobilizing. Mm. You know, Bangladeshis, alhamdulillah, have a very ummatic mindset.
Mm.
All you have to do is just Google any ummatic issue, Bangladesh protests. It will always come up, Jalalabai. Whether it's Palestine, whether it's Uyghurs, whether it's Modi visiting India, whether it's Kashmir, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Muslims of Bangladesh, they protested for Syria. They have an ummatic mindset. We forget that even the notion of Pakistan or an Islamic nation state began with the Muslim League thinkers and intellectuals of modern-day Bangladesh or Bengal.
Yeah.
So I think the Ummah, especially those of us in the West, especially those of us in the UK, you know, on the basis of Islamic Brotherhood, you know, should be speaking out and affording their platforms to raise awareness about this. We don't need to give a deep explanation, but I will just repeat the hadith and the analogy that we always say, and that is that the parable of the believers is that of a body. That when one part of it aches, the rest of it responds in sleeplessness and fever. I also mentioned the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ when he said that the best type of jihad is a kalimat al-haq, the word of truth to a tyrannical ruler.
Mm.
Now, if you believe shooting, killing, kidnapping, torturing, arresting unarmed student protesters and teachers and other civilian members, if you think that's an act of tyranny, then you have a duty to speak up against it. You have a duty to do something. You have a duty to use your mouth. Because I know you can do a lot more than hating it from within.
Mm-hmm.
So I conclude on this. There are practical things you can do.
Yeah.
Speak about it. Use your social media platforms. The way, same way you've used it for Gaza and other oppressed Muslim groups and other social justice causes. Use it in the same way. Speak about Bangladesh. Connect with them. For the influencers, if you have Bangladeshi brothers and friends and peers, ask them what's going on. Educate yourself a bit. And again, use your platform to raise awareness about this. My appeal to Bangladeshi diaspora communities is to speak to people of influence within your community.
Yeah.
Speak to those of your family members that are Awami League. We all have them. I say this, and I know this may sound crazy, that how did Dili just describe all of that? And so many, at least in the UK context, so many facilities have Awami League members within their family members, their uncles, their dads, their brothers, their cousins, whoever it may be. And they're not always ideologues. They're not. It's sometimes it's just sheepish following. It's not even that they know the policies or the manifestos or the ideas of the Awami League. It's literally that I benefited locally when I was back home as in the union chairman politics, or I benefited from being part of this party when I was a college student or a university student, that I was part of the bribery system that got my application done so I can attain this position. You know, we spoke about Labour patronage in my podcast when he came on. I'm talking about an Awami League patronage, which is generational, which spreads way beyond the realms and borders of Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Speak to them. Speak to your members of family that who are in within the police, who are within RAB and within army, and say to them that what's happening is wrong. It's dhulm. It's unacceptable. The country will not prosper like this. No country has prospered by killing its intellectuals, by killing its future thinkers and doers. Even the Awami League supporters, you accuse Pakistan, and there is truth to this, of killing East Pakistani Bengali intellectuals in their hundreds. What are you doing to the students? Are you not killing them in their hundreds? What makes you so different to the Pakistani occupier of 71? You are killing your students. You are killing the future doctors and thinkers and intellectuals of society. These people are not the students I'm talking about. are not rogue elements of BNP or Jamaat-e-Islam. This is a lie. Sure, there could be elements and supporters of those groups within the said protest, but to discredit and to coin the entire movement as a ploy and a plot by the BNP and Jamaat-e-Islam is a shameful lie. For government officials to be speaking to the press and saying, you know, BNP and Shibir are basically dressing up as plain-clothed guys, pretending to be a Awami League, paying people for assassinations, money from London's coming. You know, one official, I forgot the gentleman's name, he was from the Ministry of Defence, he said hundreds of thousands of pounds are coming from London to fund the violence against Chatara League and to attack police officers and RAB. We're literally seeing videos of AK-47s being shot at by Bangladeshi soldiers, Bangladeshi police, RAB Action Battalion forces, by plainclothes Chatara League members. Are you crazy? We're seeing this. The world is seeing this. In the same way that Israel could no longer hide its lies, do you think Hasina could hide her lies? That time's gone now. Whether even if you cut the internet off, people will find a means and a way to get things out, right? So you can't hide it. This is not good for the country. Speak to people of influence within your family members. Speak to members who are part of the state apparatus. Appeal to them. Appeal to their, if you can't appeal sadly to their Islamic nature, then at least appeal to their fake nature of nationalism. Is this what you fought for? Is this what liberation was about? Is this what independence from Pakistan was about? So to go from one occupation to another occupation,
yeah.
Right? Is this what it is about? It isn't. It isn't. Bangladesh is a Muslim nation. It is proud of its Islam. It is a country that fought for freedom and justice. It never abandoned its Islamic identity. It never abandoned its Islam. But the sad reality is that for the best part of 50 years, it's been ruled by criminals and thugs and political mafia bosses. That's what's happened. And there's been an interchanging of power between mainly the Awami League, BNP and military juntas. This needs to change. This needs to change. And quite frankly, shooting protesters is not going to bring about that change. And all that's going to happen is that you are merely extending the noose in which the eventual hanging of before people start saying I'm calling for the hanging of Hasina, well, I'm sure many would actually agree with that on the ground with the death and destruction that we've seen. But you can't hide the fact that we're seeing police officers and, you know, state officials shooting guns. You know, there was even one video where a journalist told a police officer, can you shoot the gun again so I can capture it?
Yeah.
Wallahi, this is the state in which we've reached to now, where journalists, pro-regime journalists are saying to officers, run that again so we can just capture it. They're treating this as a Bollywood scene.
Yeah.
But there's over 1,000 dead. Mm-hmm. Tens of thousands injured and in prison. Political violence is the norm, but when we're having people reach out to us saying, no, this is something different.
Yeah.
You know, they won't lightly liken it to what Assad did. They won't lightly liken it to previous massacres, right? They are. That's because the situation is dire. Now, for those of you who are now saying, oh, but what about petitions and what about writing to your MPs? Do all of that. Do I believe that it would bring any kind of meaningful change? No. But do I believe that you should do it so you can stand in front of Allah Azza wa Jal on Yawm al-Qiyam and say, Ya Allah, I couldn't do this. I couldn't speak to an influential. I didn't have that tentacle of influence or reach or access, but I signed this petition. Mm. There's a change.org petition calling for the UN to disengage Bangladesh from its UN peacekeeping forces. Now, people will be wondering, why would you do that? Because Bangladesh and Hasina takes that very proudly. Mm-hmm. The fact that Bangladesh sends UN peacekeeping forces as part of that, you know, she sees that as a great pride. Mm-hmm. So people are now calling upon the same Bangladeshi army that's been given orders to shoot out unarmed protesters is not fit to be keeping peace anywhere else if they're failing to keep peace in their own country. Yeah. You can write to your MP, but I've already explained to you, tough luck with writing to Tulip Siddiqui. Mm-hmm. But you got Rupa Haq, you got Roshanara Ali, you got Absana Begum. These are MPs that should be speaking out, you know, because this is also the country of their heritage. Mm-hmm. Every Muslim MP should be speaking out. The five independent MPs should be speaking out. You should write to them. You should ask them to raise this issue in Commons. But what will truly bring change to Bangladesh, Jalal Bhai? Well, that's the question we have and ask often on camera. It's what our respective projects are dedicated to. Yeah. What will true change come, not just in Bangladesh, but that region and the Muslim world as a whole? Will it come from alternating opposition parties that are guilty of some of the things that we accuse Hasina of today? Yeah. I don't believe it is. Yeah. Allah knows. But we have to do whatever's within our means to speak out for our brothers and sisters and to try bring about an automatic change. And Bangladesh is very much part of that conversation. If you think of, if you accept the figure that there's 1.8 billion Muslims, well, guess what? 50% of them are in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. Add another 10% to Indonesia. The vast majority of the ummah in that part of the world, right? So we should care. We should care about Bangladesh as much as we care about Kashmir, as much as we care about the Uyghurs, as much as we care about Palestine. We don't have to keep saying that. I don't like doing oppression Olympics, right?
Yeah.
I don't have to. We shouldn't have to convince the ummah, at least those who are at least religiously aware and astute, why you should speak for this. We're not saying that you will feel the same, because we would have, as someone who's of Gujarati heritage, the Gujarat massacre will have a different thing in your heart to, let's say, Kashmir would to a Pakistani, or the Rohingya issue would do to a Bangladeshi. We accept that. Or the Palestinian issue would do for an Arab.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't have to continuously convince people that the life and honour and izzah of the Muslim is the same. And on that premise and basis, we have a duty to speak and do everything that we can, inshallah, to speak about Bangladesh, just as we would with Palestine and all other oppressed Muslims and people around the world.
Okay, Brother Didi Hussain, that's really, it's been a fascinating and thorough interview. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for your time.
Barakallah feek for having me on. The honour was all mine. And I'm sure brothers and sisters in Bangladesh and beyond who will view this podcast will make du'a for you, and it will be very much appreciated that you've had this engagement, this conversation.
Amin, yeah.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website thinkinmuslim.com to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.